non-halachic segment of Torah, meaning, for lack of a better label, anything that's not focused towards halacha. There is a broad range of things. Some of it is mussar, which is inspiring people to do the right things, exhorting them, and that's the focus of it. And that's very important. Examples of that are sfarim like Mesillas Yesharim, Arkos Tzaddikim, Chovos Halvavos, and so on. Now, there's another group which deals with those mitzvos that a person that mainly are in a person's mind, such as faith, belief, and things of that nature. It's much harder to define them, and if it's taken on different, it's taken on different structures by different sfarim that were written. And it's hard. There have been sfarim written that are very philosophical. A lot of Spanish philosophers were like that. It resembles ancient philosophy a lot, dealing with a lot of difficult ideas and based on sort of extrapolated reasoning. That's one genre of sfarim. There are Kabbalah type sfarim, which deal with a different mesoros of Kabbalah. The Rambam is somewhere in the middle, and the fact that the Rambam in his sfarim seems to tread a very fine line of what is absolutely necessary, as far as these are points that are absolutely necessary for the structure of understanding Judaism, and versus going off on a tangent or going into any particular school. It is more in Avuchim and some of his other sfarim, he does elaborate more, but in the Sefer, as the whole Rambam, it's very, very structured and to the point and specific. So that's it's an advantage of studying it, because you get a very clear sense of the structure. Secondly, the second point, the Rambam's greatness is, I would say, 3 points is specifically great in what he's written. First of all, it's people don't realize how difficult it would have been to write a Rambam. The Rambam is summing up the Gemara, and theoretically, almost every law in the Rambam can be traced back to a Gemara. But imagine, let's take science as an example. We have a doctor here. Imagine nobody would have put forth any theories of science, and you just would have experiments of 200 years worth of experiments, and nobody, and you'd have to start making sense out of it. I don't think there's a human being that could do that. It's just because everybody's done a little set of experiments and made a little theory, and it's been proven, not disproven, and whatever, and then somebody else puts together 2 or 3 theories and builds a bigger theory. You build on sub-blocks and sub-blocks and so on. That's the way you build up a system. The Gemara is discussions. It's discussions, debates, and many times the Gemara comes to a conclusion. But it's very loose, and you've got to say to yourself, well, in one place a conclusion like this, in another place it's different. Are they arguing? Are they talking about different cases? Are they merely looking at different aspects of the same case? It was extremely difficult. And the Rambam writes, that's why he put it together. So basically, to make a structure out of something as amorphous as the Talmud is tremendous. Now, looking back, it's simple. It's just like if you have a scientific theory, any student could simply take the facts and check them against the theory. It's not a problem anymore. To do it backwards, if I have the theory and I say, these are the experiments, explain them in light of the theory, if the theory is correct, it's a cinch. So once we have the Rambam today, it's very simple to go back and say, hey, well, this is this Gemara, this is this Gemara, this is this Gemara, and he must obviously feel this Gemara is arguing, and this overrules this. It's a very simple feat going backwards. It was awesome going forward, and he did it with the entire Talmud. So one thing is the actual creating a structure for something which was basically amorphous was an awesome undertaking. And unfortunately, we don't give it enough credit, because we see it after it's done. Secondly, this logical structure of the Rambam is extraordinary. Basically, he had a million laws, and he made a perfect outline. A perfect in the sense that you can learn a lot from the outline. It's not just convenient. If certain laws are in a certain subdivision, then you can actually point out a lot of things about that and say, this law comes from this angle, not from that angle. So the structure of the Rambam is extraordinary. The third thing that the Rambam is really, really extraordinary in is the sharpness of his language. He tried to be as precise, as concise as can be, and really, really focused his words as in as sharp as explanation as he could. There is not anything meant to be extra or, let's say, not precise. And in Halachic part of the Rambam, a lot of that, when you learn the Gemara and you work the Rambam, it comes out much more sharply in focus. In these areas, it's a little bit less, but it's still very, very pronounced, both the structure and the sharpness of it. What is different in this part of the Rambam is the lack of sources as strict as in Halacha. In Halacha, the sources are very strict. The Rambam will never say anything that's not clearly sourced. He doesn't bring the source, but there's no such thing as the Rambam set a law. There are maybe a dozen places where he says, I feel this would be the case in such and such a, this would be the law in such and such a case. It's almost always weighing the Gemaras and coming up which Gemara feels important. In this area, A, there are much fewer pieces, there are much fewer areas of Talmud. Secondly, those areas of Talmud that deal with these topics are vague, metaphorical, difficult to pin down, and it's part of his greatness, A, that he was able to structure it somewhat, and B, he filled in some of those blanks, the gaping blanks, with really hard to find that there was any real source for it, except for what he felt was a simple, rational bridge between what's there and what's not there. So it's got a little bit less of sourcing in these chapters. One more point that I think is important to mention. In Halacha, we have a very clear sense of what is the halacha and what's not. We have a tradition of going from A to B to C. There's a Gemara, there are Rishonim, you weigh the shittas, and all sorts of different ways of doing it. In these areas, so if somebody has a halachic ruling, thanks a lot, if somebody has a halachic ruling, then there's a fairly clear pattern of how it should go. And there is not much room to have an extraordinary opinion. You can have one, but it doesn't carry much weight halachically. In this area, which we'll call Yesod HaTorah, which means just the basic fundamentals, there is no clear halacha. No one wrote a Shulchan Aruch. There was no head-to-head arguing of opinions like you have in the Gemara. Very, very difficult to say it's like this and not like that. So you don't get a clear sense of halacha. What you do get is a general sense of a majority of opinion, a minority of opinion, and an extraordinary opinion. And it's important. People say, the Rambam says this and this. Thank you. The Rambam says, sometimes the Rambam will say something which is extraordinary, and it's important to put it in this perspective that it is the Rambam's opinion, and it's respected as such, but almost everyone disagreed with him on that point. It's hard to say right or wrong, but it's important when quoting and when putting something down, it's a big difference whether it's one opinion, it's a majority opinion, or it's an extraordinary opinion, which the Rambam has a right to be an extraordinary opinion, but it's important to note that that's what it is. Those are some of the introductions I wanted just to put down, and now we'll see it inside. I'll read it in Hebrew. It's kind of short on language, so that means you don't need to follow it inside. It would be nice to have text. Maybe some other time we'll photocopy. Okay. The Rambam structured his entire work around mitzvos. He starts off each book of his, Sefer Mada. This is the book, which is knowledge, I guess is what's quoted. Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, subdivision, the fundamentals of Torah. And then he starts, there are the following mitzvot involved, and I will explain them. This is consistent the Rambam all over. So the Rambam starts the first two mitzvahs are to leida sheyesham alaka, to know that there is a God, and shlo yala b'machshava sheyesham alakai zosver, and that a person not entertain the idea that there is any other type of deity. And now he's going to explain it. So I'll read it inside slowly. And one, Yesod HaYesodos, the foundation of all foundations, Vamud HaChachmos, and the pillar of wisdom, Leida SheYesha Motzi Rishon, it is to know that there is a primary being, V'umamtzi Kol Nimtza, and he brought everything else into existence. That's the first sentence of his, and I'd like to go a little bit onto some of the points. The first thing is the fancy language he starts with. It is the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdoms. It is interesting that the first letters are Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey, which is Hashem's name, and that's done by later. It's something that's common in later works. To the best of my knowledge, this is one of the earliest examples of it. It's unusual. The Rambam couldn't have done it in many other works. It's written in Arabic, so he couldn't have done. Somebody actually raised the question, like, why didn't the Rambam do this type of thing or anything else? And he says, well, so someone said, well, I don't understand. It was written in Arabic. There's no way they couldn't do it in Arabic. But that's fine. But the Rambam tends to shy away from flowery language, and especially in this work. I'd like to explain what it means, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of wisdom. What's the difference in a foundation and a pillar? When you build on ground, and the ground is not the ground is loose or it's weak, so you put in a foundation. You'll correct me on this, Dennis, if I'm...
You got it right.
I got it right, okay. We didn't even get the building committee yet. This is afterwards. This is the contract. And you've got a building has to rest on something. So either you make like a concrete surface or you put in piles and surround the earth, but it's got to be a foundation on which you're resting everything else. Knowledge or wisdom has to rest on some axioms. There is no way a person can, there is no wisdom in the world that stands in midair. It has to stand on some sort of solid ground which is not movable or shakable. And every system of thought has some axioms that it's dealing with. All of the understanding of Torah rests on certain basic understandings. It's not that this is more important than the rest of Torah, which is a point made a lot, that it's not as if we believe that belief is everything and doing the mitzvot is extra, but the primacy of belief is that mitzvahs are meaningful only as much as the bedrock they stand on. For instance, if a person is kind to someone because it's socially a nice thing, so the whole value of the mitzvah, as nice as he is, it's not better than what it's standing on, which is acceptance, social acceptance. That's the ground that it's standing on. If a person does something because he's frightened by somebody, or a person got very sick and that's why he does tshuva, so somewhere along the line his activities are resting on a bedrock of self-preservation. Everything that you, all, any system, any religious system is resting on some bedrock of basic premises or axioms. So this idea that he's putting forth, he said, is the foundation of all foundations. This is going to be the bedrock that everything else will rest on. That is foundation. Pillar is the following. Now you have a foundation, and you need to spread the strength of the foundation, or let's put it the other way around, you need to rest the rest of the building on the strength of the foundation. So you build out pillars and columns to so that the structure will rest on it and transfer the weight down and so on. Within the Torah itself, you get an extension of some of these ideas. And for instance, the belief that there is a God who created people and therefore he has the right, absolute right to prescribe a person what his life should be like and what he should do and so on, is the axiom for the validity of Torah in general. And that's fine. And even if these acts were to be just whims, but it's his absolute right. We are total dependents, and this is what God ordained, and that's that. But within the mitzvot themselves, we notice a thread of this idea that God, unity of God, and the pervasiveness of God, all of these things are like they're sort of a thread that go through all the mitzvot. It's not just, I'm God, that's what I said, and that's that, and then the whole building just rests on that. Within every floor of that structure, you get a sense of God, his unity, his providence, and so on and so forth. So, and that is what he means, the columns of, or as he calls it, the pillars of wisdom. Wisdom is where that where those axioms follow into follow further into the building. Just like when you study any discipline, you start with axioms, and then let's take geometry. You start with some basic axioms, and then each level you build one on top of the other, and that is the wisdom. That's the science of geometry. Are those continued buildings afterwards? So, A, we have it as the bedrock of all mitzvot. It's what gives mitzvot validity, is that there is a God who can dictate so. And B, this becomes the thread that runs through all mitzvot and Torah. It structures one on top of the other, a continuation of this. Okay, that is point one in the Rambam. Then he says, later, to know. This is a very interesting term, because one of the issues that there was a lot of argument about is the nature of belief. There were some, let's take two extremes. There were some philosophers, Jewish religious philosophers, who very much were rationalists and believed that all belief should be built on human understanding, philosophy, and so on. To the other extreme, where you had Hasidic people, like Breslov, for instance, I just pluck one out, that very much favored simple, innate, naive, not in a derogatory way, but in a descriptive way, a belief. And somewhere along the line you had Lubavitch. We have no Lubavitches there, we have semi-Lubavitches. They felt that it has to be built on a certain amount of reason, but more not human reason, not philosophical reason, but more Kabbalistic reasoning. And some of the Hasidim rejected that, actually. There was when the Bala Tanya came out with his Tanya, there was opposition to it. One of his closest friends, the Kalisker, was upset with it, and he felt that a system of such intellectual pursuit contradicts what Hasidus came to teach, and there was an argument between two Gdol Olam about it. But at any rate, what is the mitzvah of belief? To know, to study, to argue, to prove, just to intuitively believe. The Rambam used the word leida. Now, an interesting note is, in a Sefer Mitzvot, he uses the term lahamin, which means to believe. What's interesting about it is that this was a problem that was raised a lot. And one of the solutions is simply that was written in Arabic, Sefer Mitzvot. And the term, I don't know the Arabic, I'm just parroting. So if anybody cares to look it up, you can look it up. There was a big Gaon called Reb Chaim Heller. He lived in New York. He was one of the unsung Gaonim. He was an extraordinary person. He knew Arabic and Greek and everything. Besides being a Gaon in Torah, he really was an extraordinary person. Rev Yoshua Soloveitchik held him to be one of his seminal figures, one of his Rebbeim. He was a quiet, unsung person. I don't even think he had an official job, but he was a real genius. And he did another translation of Sefer Mitzvot, and he said the word used is the Arabic atkad, which means knowledge and not belief. So the translation here is leida, whereas the translation in Sefer Mitzvot, well, here is the actual word leida. So this is definitely superior. This is written in Hebrew by the Rambam. Sefer Mitzvot, he claims that it also means to believe, to know, and therefore it's the same. Now let me just explain, what does it mean it's a mitzvah to know? Both terms are very difficult to understand. You can't, and one of the first questions raised was, how can you command people to believe? Like, who are we talking to? If the person believes, then fine. If the person doesn't believe, so telling him the Rambam says you ought to believe is not gonna get you very far. Like, who are we commanding? There was I was in Yerushalayim, there was a bookstore, some of you remember Lichtenstein and Holder's on Strauss. There was a bookstore there, and Mr. Holder was passed away a few years ago. He was born in Yerushalmi, and he became much more modern. He was clean-shaven, he was he pursued secular knowledge. He was a very nice person, very intelligent person, but he became very modern, and he was once losing the store with someone, and he told them a story about himself. He said he was a little boy who grew up in Bati Ungarm. Bati Ungarm is like the Meir Sharm of Meir Sharm. You can't get closer to the fire than that. It's like, it really is sad. And he started getting curious. He started reading. And one of the works that he picked up was the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed. So he wouldn't read, you couldn't read it openly. It was sort of contraband. So he kept it under his covers, under his pillow. You're shocked, Mrs. You're not shocked. So, and so he would keep it under his blanket, on his pillow. His mother was a simple woman, but a mother's a mother, and she's got a good sense of intuition. She said, "What's going on? You know, something's going on here. Like, what is it that you keep reading?" Well, she found it. She said, "It's the Rambam's work, Guide for the Perplexed." She was clueless about anything. She said, "Well, what you know, like, why do you have to read it under the pillow and under the bed? Like, you know, if there's nothing fishy about it, you could do it downstairs in shul." So he said, "Well, I really want to find out if there's a God in that." So his mother said, "For that, you need the Rambam? You would have asked me, I would have told you a long time ago." Which is, you know, it's a very sweet. I think when he set up that story, he was holding that stage of life where he thought maybe his mother was right after all. But fine. So to tell somebody to believe, you can't tell somebody to believe. A mitzvah to know is also, what does it mean it's a mitzvah to know? To study the works. You either understand it, you can make a mitzvah to study, you can make a mitzvah to attempt to understand, but what does it mean a mitzvah to know, to understand? It's something that I would refer to a little bit later, and not this point, but it's a point to bear in mind.
Can I do something?
Yes. Correct.
Meriwether Post Pavilion. Don't go to the other place because then you'll be surrounded by Farrahead. Must be saying something about what he. This connectivity.
Okay. Let me. Okay. So, let me maybe, since you've mentioned the point, so let's maybe just talk about it because it is an important point. What exactly is the mitzvah he's going to be giving over the fundamentals of faith? And we've sort of eliminated, it can't be that he's telling you you got to believe, because it's very hard to tell somebody you got to believe. This doesn't make any sense. Either a person is convinced or not convinced. You can't, to say that you have to study, you're just outlining points. He's not really giving a course of study about it. So let's focus on the word dat. In Hebrew, every language is a language that's rich only in particular words, and I guess they're very significant. Knowledge and wisdom has a lot of different shades of synonyms to it. There's chachma, there's bina, there's das, there's haskel, and the seichel, all sorts of words. Das in particular is the following. The word das is used, as Rabbi mentioned, is used in connection. It says when Adam married his wife and lived with her, it was called dat. Vayeda Adam eschava. In knowledge is the following. I'm sure that everyone believes here that there are people starving in India. And, you know, I don't think anyone denies the fact. And I think everyone is with me that it's a terrible thing that people should starve. But I don't think anyone here is ever pulled out his checkbook and written a check for kids in India. Whereas if somebody's neighbor is down or they need something, people have worked, brought them over a meal or whatever it is, whatever context that they've needed it, or shul or something. What's the difference? It's not that you know one to be true or not to be true or anything. It's how much has that knowledge crossed into the person's being, in the sense of his active person. How much has that knowledge really filled him up? People know that smoking is not healthy. In mind, when I grew up, I'm sure everyone here, smoking was a very social activity. I mean, you smoked and it was fine. People knew that smoking was healthy. It's not when you witness someone who's sick, God forbid, and you know smoking caused it, it drives the point home, not because you didn't believe it till then, but there's a certain level of how much is that knowledge, gut knowledge, and how much is it sort of intellectual knowledge. The people starving in India are, it's intellectual knowledge. We know it, and no one doubts it, and so on and so forth. It hasn't hit home to the person. Da'at is the knowledge when it crosses over from being just a rational type of thing to being a part of the person's mitzias, part of the person's reality. So belief is the same thing. If we believe that God created the world and there's a purpose for man and there's direction, all these things, I don't think anyone doubts it once they're religious. What religious people struggle with is not the philosophy of it, but how much does it really mean to me? How meaningful is it to me? It's all in the seichel, and no one who is religious, certain people are born religious, no one ever entertains doubts, except for that Mr. Holder who had to read the Rambam. But for most of us, for most of the people, that's never an issue. But the issue is, how much does it become vivid to you, real on a physical level? So Leida is one of the ways of understanding it is, and a very prominent way of understanding it is, that it become part of the person's reality. That the person think about it, understand it, picture it, and live it so that it becomes part of his mitzvahs. So the mitzvah is to take those ideas and reinforce them in a way, and every person is different in this, in a way that they are, that they become part of the body almost. They become part of the gut instinct rather than just understandings and knowledges and philosophy.
So that the mitzvah is to make it part of
it? Yes, and that's possible to say. So now I'm talking to a person that believes, and he knows it, but he's lazy. He'd rather not think about it. Just like the person who smokes, he knows. Nobody thinks it's healthy, but he just pushes out of his mind the consequences. To live it is really the mitzvah. And yes?
To make it real for yourself,
yeah,
is one thing. But I think that there's a strong implication of involving yourself with that other, you know, like the boomer eye valve thing.
Yeah.
In other words, if I talk to a patient about making it real for himself, then smoking is going to kill him.
Yeah.
And he does something about that for himself.
Right.
That's different than having a relationship with that thing. And I feel that the Rambam is saying involve yourself with God, and by knowing, but to the extent that you internalize, that you know that Hashem is
well,
the prime mover of everything, and to the extent that you meditate on that and you work with it and you make that real for you, and that penetrates everything that you're doing, then you're involved, you develop a relationship with
In a certain sense, that's a direction. The Rambam, who in Guide for the Perplexed, says that the purpose of all mitzvot is to gain some knowledge of God. So what's the point of doing it all? I think that's the point that you're making. Mitzvot are when you do act, for instance, and this is a theme that's very common, a person can sit and think about Pesach and talk about it, and there's a certain level of understanding that comes with it. When you eat something bitter, and when you eat matzos, and that, there is a vividness to it that imprints itself, that all the talk in the world is just not going to do it. So mitzvot as a whole are that type of involvement with God that has in itself a stamp of reality that you could not have just by discussing ideas and talking about it. So in a sense, very possible. Okay, now let's see one more point in. Leida sheyesha matzu rishon, to know that there is a prime being. This is a very, very important point. It's a little bit of a difficult point. Let's take an argument that is used to discuss God, to prove God, quote unquote. I don't like the word proof in these things, but people use it to prove God. And it works as follows. Where did this world come from? Came from the Big Bang. Where does Big Bang come from? I don't know. We'll find another thing. Where did that come from? Gee, I'm stumped. I don't know. So the scientist has been stumped. Okay, Mr. Religion. So what do you say? Big Bang. And where did that come from? God. And where did God come from? You're not allowed to ask that. So the only real difference is that we're just more frum than they are. You know, like if somebody would come up with a frum science and say, well, science does not permit those, which is actually a formula used. You know, it's not, the system does not allow for that question. Then fine. Then you're off the hook. So what is it? So in a certain sense, you know, you're coming with the same point, except that you're frum. Say, oh my. I think the famous Stephen Hawking story where a lady, he was lecturing, and she said, you know, all that talk is fine, but we all know the world stands on a giant turtle. So he said, ma'am, and what does the turtle stand on? So she told him, well, you think you're smart, it's turtles all the way down, sir. That's the you know, it's like Tamura Chachma, the turtles all the way down. So where are we different? What?
It's a Gansa turtle.
It's a Gansa turtle.
That's awesome.
Where are we different? So understand it the following. What that direction of that argument is. I'm a person with no beliefs and understanding, and so my elementary reaction is, it's not possible that anything exists outside the concept of logic and axioms the way I have them. And as a scientist, I mean any sane, balanced person will reject something that doesn't make sense. You know, and rightfully so. So a person sits down in a world, no axioms, no preconceptions, no prejudices. And he asks himself where everything comes from. It makes no difference what solution he comes up with, but the question always begs itself, where did that come from? Now, all that tells me is that cause and effect are not the reality of the world. There can't be an endless cause and effect, because there's no such thing as an infinite cause and effect. It doesn't make sense. I come to a problem here. I cannot say, cause and effect is the basic building block of human logic. It's the most axiomatic perception. A causes B. For everything, there is a cause before. There's no such thing as for no reason. So my logic, or my most elementary logical perception, comes to a point where it asks itself, and it's not a question, I'm not just saying it comes to a certain point, a specific point. I don't mean to say, well, we don't know where the Big Bang comes from. I'm saying it's like one of those math things where if you prove n plus 1 is an unknown, that means there's no real solution because you'll always move it over 1. There is no way in which the where from can provide an answer for, I think this is mine. I think I'm supposed to turn upside down. Okay, so there is no way that question of where from is the reality of the world. The world exists, and it has to come from someplace, and yet someplace is not a right answer because there is an infinite amount of someplaces, and I still haven't answered the question. So the only thing that I can say honestly is the following. Within the structure of the world as I know it, cause and effect are a correct approach, and it makes sense. But that is not the entirety of reality. That's not the entirety of the system. There must be point A of origin that cause and effect do not apply to it. Or else we're in a paradox. All I can say is, and like sometimes science will come to a point and say, I don't know what it is, but I can define about it. I can say that X is greater than Y, even though I don't know what the numbers are. All I can say is, for the world to exist, there must be some source which does the rules of cause and effect do not apply to it. Can I understand it? No. But that itself is what is implied. That my understanding can relate to the world as is. It can provide solutions within a context, but it can't provide the solution for ultimate existence. It just can't. The system is not good for it. So what I've proven is there must be a prime being that has the following characteristic. And again, I can just speak about the characteristics, even though it's something no one will understand. What is the most elementary characteristic of that prime being? It's as follows. If I walk into a room and I see tables, shelves, and so on, I ask myself, where did this come from? Somebody must have donated it, somebody must have built it, somebody must have set it up, somebody must have placed it. Fair. If I walk into a room that's empty, there is no question, why is this room empty? That's a non-question. It's empty because everything's empty until somebody did something to change it. So in things in this world, non-existence is a default state, and existence is a state that requires a reason for it. There must be some point in the great reality where existence is a default setting and non-existence is a question. If God's not around, the question is why not and where is he not here? If he is here, the question from where does not apply. Do I understand it? No. I can work with it, but I can't understand it because my mind is not of that type. My mind is limited, it's physical, and it's got the sense of when you walk into a place, you know, and it's built up, the question is who built it? No one's going to say, well, it just happened to be that way. It doesn't. No things happen to be that way. Things are only there when somebody is done it. But the solution to the reality in its large scope is there must be a point, a primary point, that comes, its existence is intrinsic to itself. It does not need, it does, the question from where does not apply to it. And it's an important point. Do I understand it in the way I understand things that are natural to me? No. But can I define it on paper? Yes. And I mean, anyone who's taken science or math, there are plenty of things you work with. You work with the square root of minus one, even though it's a physical impossibility. We don't have it, but it does work in the equation as long as you keep it with, you know, in its right quadrant and you work with the laws. It's fine. It's I can work with it, even though for the life of me, nobody ever saw square root of minus one. It's you know, it just doesn't exist in any physical reality that we can really put our fingers on. So and yet I can work with it because I know what its structure is like. It's the same thing. No one can understand what it means that a thing exists because it exists. It's you know, you ever catch a child, you know, like you walk in a room and you're like, hey, where did the hole in the window come from? It just happened to be here. You know, things don't happen to be, and we don't have any feel for that. We don't understand for that. But what's like? But in God, that is the definition of God. So this is what I'm finished. So I have the. God is a primary being, meaning there is a point that is primary in the sense it's got no why for its existence. It needs no why for its existence. It is primary in the sense like primary numbers that are built not by any previous construction, but because it's what it is. Yes?
It's interesting that you brought up a child. I was thinking about that right before you said it, because pre-logic state,
yeah.
the early child state, and Piaget and a lot of the other child development people talk about this, you hear them say, well, just because.
Yeah.
Why? Just because. Just because.
Right.
It just is. This is a very common statement of children, and it's very interesting because you can read in various parts of the Masorah people saying that a person can do a great deal of avoda to come to the simple understanding of the child. In other words, you go through this logical process to arrive to a place of simplicity.
Well, part of it is because a child has to, and I think I've also, you every axiom, it stops at that. Axioms don't have a construction, so a child has to pick up a certain amount of axioms and just because, or in Ivrit, kacha. That's the, you know, kacha covers almost every difficult situation. So by the way, it happens to be one of the fascinations, I think, like with Harry Potter. I haven't read any books, but my kids have actually, and I think one of the fascinations, people like things that just come from nowhere. It's like, you know, a castle doesn't have to be built by anybody, no construction company and no building committee and nothing. It just, poof, you know, it's there. You know, like it's there's something that people like about that idea. So,
really,
then it'll make life simpler, no? You just go like this, and it's there. Things are there because they're there. But at any rate, so the first definition of God is that he is a primary being. Matzi Rishon. There are, Ramchal says very similar. There's another term used similar to this by some of the other sperm, and I'll mention it. It's called Mitzius Hamukrachas, which means literally existence that is that has to be. An existence, not necessary in the sense necessary for something else, but it is... It exists, it has to be that way. That's the Mitzius Mokrachas, that's the term used. And it means the same thing. So the first thing is this understanding that there is a primary being of existence. One more word. V'hu mamtzi kol hanimtza. And he gave existence to everything else. And this is a point that is going to, the Rambam will elaborate later, and it's an important point. When we picture ourselves against God, against meaning the sense vis-a-vis. Now, we think of God as being stronger, wiser, ancient. We look for superlatives to find out how God is better, stronger, whatever, however you wish us. And it's very much, this is the society we live in the Goyish society. I mean, a person believes in God, believes that he's great, wonderful, fantastic, and so on. Fine. It's not the belief in God that we have. The belief in God is that everything else you can compare. We are smart, a little bit smart, and God is infinitely smart. We are a little bit kind, God is infinitely kind, and whatever. The one thing that is completely distinct is existence. God exists because his existence needed no reason to exist. Therefore, its existence is intrinsic. For instance, let's take something an example. A person who is musical will always be singing because that's his nature. That's his neshama. He's a singer. He's a person who sings and that's it. A person who has to sing because they put him in a choir, he's lonely, he heard a nice tune, that singing is only going to take a small amount of time because something brought it on and therefore it's going to go. It's not going to stay around because it's not intrinsic to the person. It happened for a reason. So that limits, I can't say the person is a singer. He sings on occasion. He has a reason to sing. He is singing, but he's not a singer or an artist or whatever it is. When we say that God, we exist, since our existence was brought about by something, we don't exist because we intrinsically exist. So you can't term a person an existence. God exists because his existence needs no reason, as we explained before, and therefore you can't take anything away which would make it stop existing. Therefore, existence is correct definition of God. The word that we use for God, in not as a relative term, powerful, mighty, but yud and hey and above and hey, which is the most central name of God that we have, comes from the root of existence. The Rambam says it somewhere in Mor Nevuchim, actually speaks about it, and he says it in an extraordinary way. He says it, it's extraordinary the way he presents it. The Rambam says the following: God, Hashem, Moshe asked God, they're going to ask me your name. What shall I tell the Jews is your name? So he says, Eke, Aleph, Hey, Yud, Hey, which is the same root as Yud, Kei, Vav, Kei, Asher, that Eke will I am the one that will exist, who will exist. In Hebrew, the construction is extremely, extremely difficult construction. I am the one who will be, that indeed will be. I mean, it's one of those areas where you can't really fill in a good translation. Eke, Asher, Eke. The Rambam says the following. It's awesome pshat in Mor Nevuchim. He says, Eke Asher Eke means the following. The word Asher in Hebrew connects an adjective to a noun. Yaakov Asher Poda. Ruvain Asher Gozal. Asher is a term which is a descriptive connection. It's a preposition that connects the noun. So when I say Yaakov, who stole, who's the Yaakov Asher Ganav, or whatever it is. So the Rambam says, every being in the world, its existence has some reason why it exists. so-and-so because he was put into this world. So-and-so because these are his parents and gave him a body. So-and-so because of this. All things in every being in the world has an existence for a reason. God is the only thing that existence loops around itself, so to speak. Eke, asher eke. I am the one who exists because I exist. I am the exister who exists. It's sort of, the adjective loops around itself. I'm X that equals X, which is not possible. I mean, logically, that's a meaningless statement, except for God, where it means I'm the only thing in the world that existence is intrinsic to me. So the Rambam says, Moshe was introducing a new concept. He asked God, how will I introduce the concept of God to the people? They were slaves. They were sunk into Avodah Zarah. What should I tell them? The powerful is going to come to redeem them, the mighty one. So he said, Eka she'eka means the existence which exists because it exists. Basically, that's what he says. So Eka she'eka is the same as the Yud Kei Vav Kei. So we have to understand that God is the primary being, and anything else has existence only because God endowed our existence. Let me just sum up. So we've done the first half of the first halacha. I mean, obviously, the first halacha is... these down as axioms for the rest of Torah, plus this will be a thread that will be within Torah, and the Rambam, Emor Nebuchim, almost all the reasons that he gives for mitzvot are belief in God, unity of God, and so on. We touched upon the point later, what it means knowing, and in what sense, what is the obligation of belief. And the definition we gave was das, meaning a knowledge which has become concretized, and a knowledge that's passed from being just logical or intellectual to something which becomes very, very much part of the person. We explained that the basic belief is the God's existence. Prime existence is how God is defined in contrast to anything else in the world. And anything else in the world, its existence, the word existence, is simply it draws what we call existence from God, but it's got no real existence on its own. Okay, so we'll hold it here.
know you do.